Hello, and welcome once again to the MANCAD, Rich Academy of Audiology podcasts. You probably know by now that MANCAD is Manchester Centre for Audiology and Deafness, and that we're located at the University of Manchester in the UK. I'm Gabrielle Saunders. I'm a Senior Research Fellow at MANCAD, and I moderate our podcasts. We're discussing all sorts of topics, things that are specifically related to COVID, and sometimes they're not. But they're all topics that are relevant to audiologists and researchers and people interested in hearing and hearing loss. We record a new podcast each month, and each one is about 20 to 30 minutes long. And what we do is we put the audio recording along with the transcript on our MANCAD University of Manchester website. On to today, we have a double bill. I'll be chatting to Cynthia Morton and Elliot Shearer. Both are from Harvard Medical School in the US, and Cynthia also has a part-time faculty position at MANCAD. Cynthia is a medical geneticist and Elliot's a pediatric otolaryngologist, and they share longstanding interest in the genetics of deafness. They've got a particular interest in comprehensive newborn hearing screening to improve identification of deaf and hard of hearing children, and that's what they'll be discussing today, but specifically genetic newborn hearing screening. Now, before we start our question and answers, I'd like each to say a little bit more about themselves. So Cynthia, why don't you go ahead?
So first of all, I'd like to say hi to all of my MANCAD colleagues, missing you dearly, and hoping that we'll see you in perhaps early 2021. And so proud to be a part of that group. I'll say that this topic has been one that has been of great interest to me since the mid-2000s when I published a paper with the chairman of my graduate school, Walter Nance, in the New England Journal of Medicine, entitled Newborn Hearing Screening, A Silent Revolution. And since that time, have really thought that we needed to advocate for genetic etiologies incorporated into newborn hearing screening. So yeah, this is something that's really resonated with me for a long time.
Elliot, you want to say a bit more about yourself?
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me. I'm really excited to be here and talk to you. And I always love talking with Cynthia. We've been working on this project for a few years now. So I'm a pediatric otolaryngologist. I'm an attending physician at Boston Children's Hospital. And I have an appointment at Harvard Medical School. I've been interested in genetic hearing loss since I started my PhD. I worked on development of a comprehensive genetic testing platform using massively parallel sequencing, which we launched on a clinical basis in 2011. And my research is focused on genetic hearing loss and ways to improve genetic testing and genetic screening for hearing loss as a way to directly impact my patients, really. So happy to be here.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. So you've titled this podcast, Genetic Newborn Hearing Screening, Time for a Paradigm Shift. Which implies then that you're proposing a change to the status quo of newborn hearing screening. So before we get on to what you are proposing, I think it would help our listeners if you tell us a bit more about the current model of screening and what takes place in a standard newborn hearing screening. Elliot, why don't you tell us about that?
Sure. So a couple of important points. The first is that, you know, before we criticize anything, we have to talk about how successful it's been. And universal newborn hearing screening has really dramatically changed care of children with hearing loss and individuals with hearing loss. And also, I'd just like to point out that most of what Cynthia and I know are the US newborn hearing screening protocols. And so this may differ somewhat in other parts of the world. But really, the newborn hearing screening as we know it developed as a result of a lot of research in the 1990s. And that research really showed that early identification of hearing loss in children is key to best outcomes in speech and language perspectives, from a speech and language perspective. And so based on this research, the universal newborn hearing screening was proposed in the late 90s and then adopted in the early 2000s in the US. And now it's mandated in 43 states by law. And in the rest of the states, they have a newborn hearing screening program without a law. And really, newborn hearing screening is just one step of the process. The Joint Committee on Infant Hearing, JCIH, in the United States has a guideline called the 136 guideline. And the screening is the first part of that. It's supposed to be done by 1 month of age, and diagnosis is supposed to be by 3 months, and then intervention is by 6 months. So that's where the 136 comes from. But when we think about newborn hearing screening, it's good to differentiate it and delineate it as a physiologic screen. So what I mean by that is that we're testing the auditory system function in response to sound. So we're playing a sound and evaluating a response to that sound. There's two methods that are widely used as a screening test, and it really varies in the US by state and sometimes by institution. The two different tests are otoacoustic emission, or OAE. And I think of OAE kind of like a reflex. It's kind of like hitting your knee or your patellar tendon with a reflex hammer. The sound goes into the ear, and then the ear actually plays the sound back. And so you're not actually watching the sound go to the brainstem. Whereas with the auditory brainstem response, also called ABR or automated ABR, AABR, or BAER is what a lot of people call it too. That's kind of like an EEG for hearing. So a sound is played and the electrical stimulus is followed towards the brain. And so really the physiologic newborn hearing screen, which is what most people talk about as a hearing screen, is composed of one of those two tests. And here in Massachusetts and lots of places in the US, you have an initial screen that happens in the hospital, followed by a rescreen if the patient fails that. And that's done on an outpatient basis. And then after screening comes diagnosis and everything according to the guidelines, hopefully.
So that seems pretty sort of sensible. What are the advantages? And if you're proposing ultimately a change, what are the limitations of this?
Sure. So, like I said, it's been enormously successful, and we don't want to discount that. And, you know, when it was first implemented, there was only a couple hundred children with hearing loss in the U.S. identified per year before the age of one, and now it's 6,000 or 7,000 a year. So it's been very successful. It's been widely adopted. So the most recent data in the U.S. at least shows that 98.3% of U.S. newborns are screened at least once by newborn hearing screening. And the other thing that's really important is that it's easy to train people to do this test. So most people, at least in the U.S., who are doing this screening are trained providers that go into the room and soon after a baby's born and perform a screening test. So it's not a complicated test, and it doesn't take a lot of time. So those are big advantages of it. The disadvantages that Cynthia and I and other authors focus on in the paper, where we propose this comprehensive newborn hearing screening, is that the there's four primary disadvantages that I think of. So the first is that the newborn hearing screening, as it stands in the U.S., has a high false positive rate. And what I mean by that is if you look at all the kids who are screened using newborn hearing screening, at the end of the day, only 16% of them are actually found to have permanent hearing loss, which is the goal of the screening. There's a lot of debate about semantics and the math behind this and everything, but when I think about a false positive rate and most other clinicians think about it, the goal of hearing screening is to identify permanent hearing loss in children. And 83.7% of kids that fail the newborn hearing screening and actually have normal hearing, then I think that's a missed opportunity. And that leads into the second big disadvantage of newborn hearing screening, which is loss to follow-up. So a huge percentage, about 30% of kids who fail on their newborn hearing screen don't come back and aren't evaluated again. And a main reason for this is because the screeners and the pediatricians, the people who interact with these families, they say, well, it's most likely that they have normal hearing. Which is true, it's absolutely true. But at the same time, we don't wanna lose patients, and we are losing kids who have hearing loss because they don't return to follow up. The third reason that the current newborn hearing screening could be improved is that we're not identifying certain types of hearing loss. So mild or moderate hearing loss, for instance, is often not picked up by current physiologic newborn hearing screening. Any hearing loss that occurs right after the newborn period is not identified. Specific types of hearing loss, like autosomal or auditory neuropathy spectrum disorder, ANSD, is not evaluated at all if you just perform an OAE test. So there's several different types of deafness that are not identified with the physiologic screen. And then finally, the result that you get from the screen, it's either pass or fail. You don't get any other etiology or diagnosis. It just says this test you passed or failed. And we think that's probably underlies some loss to follow-up as well, because we're not providing solid information to families at kind of a crucial juncture for them to follow up.
Yeah, interesting. So I'm guessing that the issue with the false positives is, A, the cost of the programs is higher than it need be, and then also that you're adding stress to all these parents who needn't be worrying. Is that what the main concerns right. about false positives are?
Exactly. It's a huge source of stress for parents. And actually, my daughter failed in 1 year, so I know exactly what it feels like. I mean, you've got to hand it to these screeners. I mean, they work really hard to go and screen these kids. And it's a huge, difficult topic to broach with a family with a beautiful newborn baby to say, well, they just failed this test. You know, no one wants to hear that they failed, right? And so the screeners and pediatricians are trying to help out and say, well, it's probably normal, but we think that leads to a loss to follow up.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. So what are you proposing then?
So, and Cynthia, you can chime in if you have any comments so far. So what we're proposing really is to make a comprehensive newborn hearing screening. So right now the paradigm is, you fail the screen, and then you go on to diagnosis. But really, our idea is to combine the physiologic screen with genetic screening at the same time, as well as with screening for or testing for congenital cytomegalovirus, congenital CMV, which we haven't talked about, but it, as Cynthia put so nicely in her paper from New England Journal of Medicine, it's about 20% of congenital hearing loss is congenital CMV. We won't talk more about it here on this podcast, but it's a treatable form of hearing loss, so it's very important to identify early. And so if we can combine a physiologic test, the genetic screening of at least some common genetic variants and congenital CMV at the same time, we think we'd be able to improve our ability to provide etiologic information or diagnostic information. And we'd also be able to pick up other forms of hearing loss that otherwise are missed with the current newborn hearing screen.
So the advantages then of genetic screening are clearly picking up the CMV. What else is there to add?
So there are a few clear advantages that you can make, you know, compelling arguments for. I think one is that it would allow us to optimize current and future management. For example, it could impact the choice of habilitation based on the underlying, if it is a genetic cause, the underlying genetic cause that might have other systems involved later on, such as Usher syndrome. So in the newborn just screen, a child might not pass their newborn screening test, but there would be no way to distinguish that child from a child who didn't have Usher syndrome at that point. So it certainly might influence whether the parents would choose sign language as a means of habilitation versus a cochlear implant or hearing aid. So that's one advantage. Also, it turns out we're more aware now. We've known for a while that there was an increase from the birth rate of deafness to school age. And we didn't have a really good idea about that, although I think there were some cases which were making it clear that some individuals, some babies who have well-respected genes and variants within them that are responsible for deafness are simply not penetrant in that newborn period. So they pass their newborn hearing screening tests. And yet later on, say before school age, are diagnosed with a hearing loss. And in some ways, those kids are like the kids before we even had newborn hearing screening. Their parents and their pediatrician know they passed their hearing screening, so they don't think that would be a problem. So that's been something that has been more well known now through these big screens that have occurred in Asia. Potentially some savings in the way children are worked up here, in that there could be a reduction in other testing. If you knew that the genetic etiology of the hearing loss, you might not have to worry about some other things, like you might not need to do an EKG to rule out Jervell-Lange-Nielsen syndrome, or you might not need a CT. Because you just know that that's not a finding that's associated with that particular genetic etiology that's defined. So our systems, our healthcare systems and governments really love to find ways that we could potentially use medical healthcare dollars in the best way. And in this way, it really could potentially reduce some of that follow-up testing. And the other thing that's really heartening as a geneticist is that families in Asia who received information that their child had genetic variants that were well recognized to cause hearing loss were more likely than not to come in for the follow-up testing. So the fact that the functional testing does have a false positive rate, that alone wasn't the driver in coming up for follow-up. Once they got that report that there was a genetic variant, they were really much more likely to show up for their follow-up exams. So those are a few things.
That makes a lot. So just for my own clarity then, if you do this genetic testing, it would seem that you're being more specific, and could you potentially rule out some of those false positives from the physiological testing by saying, well, also there's no genetic signs, therefore would you be comfortable in saying, well, there's fewer people we need to follow up?
Well, I don't think we would want to do that, and especially, you know, there could have been some birth trauma or some other etiology of for the hearing loss. So I think we really would want those children to continue to be followed in the regular system.
Okay, so now could you apply some of this genetic testing in other newborn hearing, non-hearing screening, but other newborn screenings?
Yeah, I really do think this is the future of newborn hearing screening. And I think that hearing and deafness are a really maybe perhaps easy place to engage the public, because many of the things that are screened for on the newborn screening programs are metabolic diseases, many of them rare disorders that maybe have scary names and they never heard of them before. And there's not a general discussion of what is on, you know, every newborn screening panel. But I feel that the public has a better understanding and less fear perhaps of deafness as a finding from a newborn screening. And there's, again, we have therapies, right? We have hearing aids, we have sign language, we have cochlear implants. So there's really something that they are also probably more familiar with than some diets that children would have to be put on to prevent disorders occurring that are related to their genetic findings. So the other thing I think that's quite true is that most kids with hearing loss are born to parents who have normal hearing. So this is not something that these families are knowledgeable of how to negotiate the system. So I think that these it would be good for them to be able to be facilitated by having a genetic etiology and following the path to the care for that. I'll just say that the newborn screening is typically a heel stick for a blood sample. So it differs from the current newborn hearing screening because it's a functional test.
Right, but because you take blood anyway, you could be using it for the genetic analysis.
That's right, and I think that plays into something else that we maybe wanted to address was the implications in screening during times like that we're living right now, which are pandemics. So I think we can talk about that as we talk about the COVID survey that we've done.
Okay, yes, which is a great segue into the COVID survey. So being the world we're in, we all keep talking about COVID. And I know that you've recently completed a study about newborn hearing screening during the pandemic. Would you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, so Cynthia and I started talking about this summer as something that we were concerned about when we saw sort of rationing of care and change in standard clinical care, at least in the United States during the COVID pandemic. And so we wanted to look at the effect on newborn hearing screening in the US during the pandemic. And the way we did this is two different ways. We looked at state level data, so actual objective data for the number of newborns that came in for newborn hearing screen. And it's surprisingly difficult to get this data in the United States because of the patchwork of states and different sort of rules for access to the data, but we did get data from five different states across the US. And then we did a nationwide survey of audiologists and newborn hearing screeners to see what they thought the effect of the pandemic was on newborn hearing screening. And what we found is a significant drop in the newborn hearing screening, the initial in-hospital screen in the United States, decreased 11 per 1,000 births, which is pretty significant. But then the outpatient secondary screen, that follow-up screen that we talked about, that dropped by 26% just during the study period. And so a lot less kids are showing back up again for the follow-up. And what we were able to calculate is that if you extrapolated that, the current COVID period data that we have, which is several months past March, to the entire US over the course of a year, we'd be missing 660 children with permanent hearing loss in the US per year. And we're not through the pandemic yet. And we expect that this trend is going to continue or even get worse, unfortunately. The audiologists and newborn hearing screeners that we surveyed, three quarters of them saw a significant change to their clinical care for these kids and newborn hearing screening. And then nearly half of them actually were deferring newborn hearing screening because of the pandemic and because of staffing issues. And what was really frightening to us is that in 40% of cases, these respondents said that they were not tracking the kids that were being lost. And so we're having this experience now where the kids will be disappearing until they show up later and are found to have hearing loss. And we know this has significant effects on their language development later. And so this represents another opportunity where we can improve the screen, because if we're only able to contact these patients at one point, typically when they're in the hospital after the baby's born, that's the time to get all the data that we need. That's the time to do all the testing that we can do at the same time. And if we're able to just get one time period to get access to them, then doing genetic testing or genetic screening as well as congenital CMV testing at the same time would be most beneficial, we think.
Yeah, I mean, that's shocking that 40% of people weren't even being tracked.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're going to do a follow-up survey, of course, to see this, but we're hypothesizing that this is just because everybody in all walks of life was scrambling to sort this out, right? And we found from survey respondents, a lot of people were being just immediately furloughed from their jobs, and so there just weren't staff and people available to do, to track. They just didn't have the manpower to do it, so.
Yeah, to the naive ones amongst us, you'd imagine that there would be like electronic chart notes that you could look back into easily enough to find out what was going on.
Yeah, you would hope so. Again, it's in the U.S., it's a patchwork of every hospital has a different electronic medical record. Even in Boston, there's three hospitals within 200 feet of each other here, and each one has a different medical record to access, and it takes time to access it and all that sort of stuff. But definitely, I'm sure, you know, everyone wants what's best for these kids, and I'm sure people are going to try to go back after. But it is disturbing to hear that we may be missing some of these kids.
Yeah. So if we'd have had a genetic testing set up, you said you think it would have been different. How do you sort of see that process would have been happening?
So as I mentioned, the traditional newborn screening test is a HEAL stick blood test. And I think there was probably much less disruption in that testing that occurred. So if there was genetic testing for hearing on that same panel, I think there would be, we would be able to at least pick up those cases that we know have genetic etiologies that lead to hearing impairment. So certainly that doesn't mean that testing doesn't ever get also interrupted, because there was a loss of newborn screening that occurred in this country following Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans. Kids were born and were not tracked. And so there was a big scramble after the hurricane to try to track down all those kids and get newborn screening performed. But I still think, had this been in the routine panel of tests, it would have been more likely to have taken place.
What proportion of newborns born deaf would the deafness be due to something that you would pick up with the genetic screening versus other forms of deafness?
It's in newborns, congenital hearing loss that's profound. Up to 60% of it is genetic, and so it's a significant proportion. The issue which Cynthia and I and other people are working on is what sort of genetic screen you would actually do. So what genes you would test for, what mutations in those genes, and that varies by how severe the hearing loss is and then the ethnicity of the individual. So there's a lot of work to be done, but that's a couple papers now from Asia have looked at testing a handful of genetic mutations and that are most common, and their results are really promising.
Oh, that's good. So if you could get this, like what is the process to try and get this happening, and you know, what might a timeline be?
So I would say we're excited to welcome a new administration into the US that values science. And to put it a little bit in context for you, although I'm sure you're bombarded with the news from our country for the past 4 years as to various things. But I have to say, I was really taken back by an article published by Politico, which was October 20th, which was indicating that the Trump administration would consider, in essence, sort of punishing cities, states whose Democratic governors were, you know, not containing, not controlling lawlessness, etc. And so actually the Department of Human Health and Human Services was asked to provide some lists. And so newborn hearing screening was on the list for being unfunded in Washington, D.C. And the mayor in Washington and our president have not seen, you know, the same on various issues. So they indicated that could be 423,000 for universal hearing screenings for newborns in the District of Columbia. And I still find a lot of things hard to believe when I hear about them, but then when I've seen happen, I don't know. I mean, somebody's put this on a piece of paper as a possible, you know, somewhat punishment.
Gosh. But so it seems that in terms of this, there is a way forward as you see it now.
Absolutely.
That is.
Gotta get through a couple more months, I guess. But I think that President-elect Biden has made it clear that he's values science and, you know, on many occasions. So I believe that this is part of that science that would have more, you know, attention and possibility at this time.
That's excellent news. So just before we end, do you have anything else either of you want to add about this topic?
Maybe we should just focus a second about what happens in England. And there is a goal for the genomic medicine laboratories to actually test for over 100 variants for newborns who don't pass their hearing testing. I mean, they're confirmed to be deaf. And then, of course, everything's gotten delayed because of COVID, but it really is putting that in place, whereas that's not always possible for us because of insurance concerns that Americans have.
Well, that's good. So the UK is probably further ahead in this, in establishing this in the US.
We still would miss the kids that are not penetrant.
Sure.
In the, you know, directly newborn period.
Sure. Yeah. Elliot, do you have anything to add?
Oh, I think it's really exciting. I mean, there's a lot of work to be done, but I think we're, everyone who looks at newborn hearing screening is kind of united in the idea that we need to improve it in order to identify these children early. There's going to be a lot of different approaches to looking at this, using different sequencing techniques, looking at different genes and mutations. But ultimately, I think doing a comprehensive genetic screen is going to help us identify infants with hearing loss.
Yeah, I think this is really exciting. And I mean, it must be so exciting to be on the forefront of like this kind of research that could have such a dramatic impact that I think that's wonderful. So thank you both for sharing your time today. It was really great. To our audience, we will have a transcript of this and we will add to the transcript the papers that Cynthia and Elliot referred to. They'll be there so you can look them up. If you've got any follow-up questions or you want to give some feedback, you can email me. And again, my email address will be in the transcript and it's on the ManCAD webpage. But in the meantime, I hope you enjoyed the discussion and you'll come back to hear the next one. And I will get the word out when that will be. So thank you all. And in the meantime, farewell and stay well.